welcome once again to EWTN's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keck, your host, our guest author, an old friend, Joe Pierce, and Classic Literature Made Simple, 50 Great Books in a Nutshell, published by our good friends at Ignatius Press. Always great to see Mr. Joseph Pierce, let me say it officially there. After all the programs you've done for us over the years and the number of book interviews we've done, I always associate you the most with The Lord of the Rings. You did a lot of that early on for us when the trilogy was coming out and talking about the Catholic underpinnings. And now you've got Classic Literature Made Simple. Now, we have a connection on this book here at EWTN as well, in the sense of some TV programs we did with you, right?
Yes, we made a series called Great Books Every Catholic Should Know, and it's based basically on this and an earlier book I wrote for Ignatius Press, which is called Literature When Every Catholic Should Know. And sort of those two ideas together sort of came together for mm-hmm. the series that I did for EWTN, which I hope has been a great success.
Right. And we also took the Nutshell idea and turned it into something, our own version of Cliff Notes, which we call Joe's Notes, which we run as spots, which hopefully have attracted some attention and informed some people, at least with the idea, maybe tantalizing the idea, maybe I should check out this book. Because I think one of the things that's surprising in this book and in talking about it is that we're not just talking about, oh, here's the books that, you know, that St. Augustine wrote, and here's the books that this holy person wrote. A lot of these books would seem on the surface not to be particularly Christian, let alone Catholic.
Yeah, so I mean, when we canonize saints, we canonize them for their holiness. When we canonize books, we talk about a canon of great books. So they're the greatest books of Western civilization. Well, Western civilization begins before the time of Christ. It begins with Homer, with the Iliad and the Odyssey. But the thing is that they are seeking Christ. So there's a lot of proto-Christian morality in there. C.S. Lewis likened the pre-Christian pagans such as Homer mm-hmm. and the philosophers such as Plato and Aristotle. He said they're like the bride awaiting for the coming of the bridegroom, whereas modern neo-pagans are like the divorcee who's walked away from the marriage. So there's a very big difference between the two, and we shouldn't get them confused. So Homer mm-hmm. and Virgil and the great philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, are looking for God and pointing in the right direction, and we can learn from them.
Right, and we can't hold it against them, the fact that they were there before Christ came.
Exactly, accident of birth. It just happened, but to be running. Of course, Christ is not going to condemn people to hell just because they happened to be born before he mm-hmm. became incarnate. Clearly, there's a baptism by desire and other things the church teaches about that. And I think we see that in these mm-hmm. works. We see that in the Iliad and the Odyssey. The Iliad is about pride preceding a fall. That's very Christian morality. You know, the Odyssey is about needing to gain humility in order to have the reward of getting home. Again, very, very much something that parallels Christianity. So we can see in these mm-hmm. works things that we should feel very comfortable with. They dovetail with our own faith.
Right. In the beginning, you say it's been said quite correctly that we write as well as we read. It could also be said equally correctly that we think as well as we read. Are people reading a lot, and are they thinking a lot, and how's the writing?
Yeah, well, that's the trouble. Of course, we live in an age where many of us are techno-addicted. We're addicted to our gadgets. I sometimes call our gadgets our godgets, because we spend more time with our godgets than we do with our God. And so I think the reason I write books like this is to encourage people to get back mm-hmm. and find the space for reading and prayer. These are things that require silence and time, and we have to get ourselves away from
being
plugged in.
That's a big problem. Two things that people feel like they don't have.
Yeah, but they spend a lot of time wasting time, you know, with their technology. They need to unplug and find mm-hmm. 30 minutes, an hour every day to spend time with great books and in good prayer.
Right. Now, you talk about, generally speaking, there are two types of good books and two types of bad books. Explain.
Yeah, so I sometimes sort of say, so logically, there are good books, good bad books, bad good books, and bad books. Mm-hmm. In other words, a book can be good in terms of art, in terms of being well written, but also good in terms of the morality that it conveys, or it can be mm-hmm. bad in both those senses. So a good bad book would be a book that's good as art, but bad as morality. Mm-hmm. So obviously we should concentrate on reading good books, which are both beautiful works of literature.
So is that like Joyce? You talk about Joyce later?
Joyce would be a case of somebody who writes beautifully, but he's poisoned by pride. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's a pernicious book.
So did they finally convince you to teach him or not teach him?
I succumbed for a couple of semesters, yeah.
Mm, okay, because you talk about that. You said we needn't waste our time on bad books. What would be your example of maybe one or two books that are very popular, people read, do you think fits into that bad, bad book?
Well, unfortunately, almost all contemporary mainstream literature, because now, in order to get published, you have to fit a template. It's a bit like being in the Soviet Union. There has to be a positively drawn homosexual character. There has to be radical relativism as ever, mm-hmm. any morality there is. And if you don't write to that template, then you're not published. So I would basically warn people against the New York Times bestseller list, because they're all bad, bad books.
Right. In fact, many times people will complain that the list is compiled politically and that certain books are left off that should be there based on their actual sales.
Yeah, well, I can absolutely be that. It's about trying to direct the culture in a poisonous and destructive direction.
You say life is too short for us to be able to read all the good books that we have written, so why waste our time on anything else? Go on to say, great books like Great Saints enrich our faith as they enrich our culture. How do they do that?
Yeah, well, basically, you know, we come to God through goodness, truth, and beauty, and we come to God through the power of story. Great stories is the way that Jesus reveals himself to us through his own life, death, and resurrection, mm-hmm. and also through his parables. That quite clearly, one of the ways that we accommodate truth, that we can gain truth, mm-hmm. is through narrative, through the telling of stories. So the great works of literature teach us about who it is to be human, hold up a mirror to who we are, and who our neighbors are, our relationship with them, our relationship with God.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, our Lord used to use, obviously, parables and stories in that sense of teaching lessons as well.
Yeah, he's showing us that basically if you want to teach him like the prodigal son, we just have to use those two words and the whole image of the story is evoked in our minds and we see ourselves in the story as the prodigal son, as the envious brother, as the forgiving father. I mean, we're all in the story. That's how powerful a good narrative can be.
We all identify ourselves.
Yes.
It's interesting that over time, in a sense, the emphasis in that story has changed depending on society's view of things.
Well, yeah, the danger is that we have to always read a work objectively as far as possible. And obviously that ultimately is as God sees it. Mm. That's not necessarily always that easy. But if we see it through the eyes of the author. So, for instance, if we judge William Shakespeare through the politics and the morality and ethos of the 21st century.
So like The Merchant of Venice.
Exactly. Well, example, I saw a performance of The Merchant of Venice back in England, when I lived in England, where all the Christian characters were skinheads. And they were kicking Shylock,
poor Shylock
spitting at him.
Okay.
He was. It's all about the victimhood of Shylock, and that's not the play that Shakespeare wrote.
He wasn't even the main character.
He's not the main character in the play at all.
Right.
You know. So it's a perfect example that we've got to be able to read a work objectively, which is to see it as the author of the work saw it, and that's a challenge. But that's what I try to explain in this book is that we can. Mm. It's not that difficult to do if we just get into the habit.
One you point out, I thought, and it came up, I think. Possibly when you were doing the series or the series of spots for us as well, was kind of the way we misunderstand Romeo and Juliet versus the way it would have been looked at the time. Explain.
Yeah, so basically Shakespeare deliberately makes Juliet only 13 years old. She's a child. Romeo's older, we're not giving his age, but he's clearly an adult, able to look after himself physically and in cynical banter. And it's a cautionary tale about allowing young people allowing themselves to become so overtaken by the power of erotic passion that they lose all power to reason and in consequence cause great harm to themselves and to others.
Mm-hmm. Now you've got, and you alluded to, you know, the Odyssey and the Iliad, and you're dealing with, again, pagan writers, etc., and at least Dante won't let him into heaven. I don't know whether our Lord lets them into heaven or not, but I know Virgil couldn't get out of purgatory, right? But you've got, like, Antigone, and you're talking about Sophocles, and what makes Sophocles the greatest dramatist in the history of civilization, and what do we get out of that by reading as a Christian today?
Well, I would say greatest other than Shakespeare, but certainly...
That's right. In fact, you did say that.
Yeah, without Sophocles, we might not have had Shakespeare, though, because it's the foundation of drama. Well, you mentioned Antigone. Mm. Antigone is a timeless drama about religious liberty. Basically, the Caesar figure in the play, the state, right, the secular power, says that because this person is a traitor, he will not have a religious burial. And Antigone said, well, he's my brother, and he has a right to a religious burial, and the state does not have a right right to take away his religious liberty. So she actually sacrifices herself to give her brother a religious service, a funeral service. So that's a timeless. I mean, every single generation, you have the secular power, Caesar, trying to control religion.
Right.
This is not anything which is odd about the pagan times. This is something which is perennially relevant.
Right. Now, you talk about the Aeneid, written by Virgil, who pops up later in Dante's story. A few decades before the birth of Christ and 7 centuries after the time of Homer. Now, is the idea, I always got the idea that in a sense it was the Romans' way of trying to show they actually had a greater founding than Romulus and Remus and a wolf or something.
Yeah, it's one-upmanship over the Greeks, absolutely.
Right.
Think the Greeks we could do better. But of course, the irony is, What is Virgil doing? He's taking the Greek epics. Without the Greek epics, he can do nothing. He's without the Greek philosophers, they can do nothing. The gods he writes about are the Greek gods. So he's really standing on the shoulders of giants, and the giants he's standing on the shoulders of are Greek giants. So it's the joke's on the Romans, really, when we're talking about this.
Because Aeneas, in theory, came from Troy, right? I mean, that's
the story.
That's what the theory is supposed to be. Now, Beowulf, we all hear about Beowulf. Everybody had to sort of read some part of it at some point. We were in high school, probably. And you say that the Beowulf poet was almost certainly a monk who was a contemporary of the of St. Bede, the Venerable. But you also point out that one of the big, theories about it is that this was a monk who really was a closet pagan, and if otherwise, it would have been much more Christian in its orientation. But you disagree with that.
Yeah, I mean, basically, everyone agrees he was almost certainly a Benedictine monk because they were the only people doing any writing at the time. He's around the same time as Bede. That's helpful because we know the sort of culture he's writing in, profoundly Catholic England at the time. And if you actually read Beowulf, it's a warning against the heresy of Pelagianism, the heresy of you can get to heaven without the need of the sacraments or the church. Mm-hmm. So it's a warning against that. Beowulf's the most powerful warrior in the world with the most powerful sword, but he cannot defeat supernatural demonic evil with physical strength, human will, or human technology. You actually need the magic sword, the sword of grace, which is given as a gift, and it's with that that he kills the demon. Mm-hmm. So this is basically very orthodox understanding of theology, which is playing itself out in the story.
In the image of the dragon.
The dragon is certainly the image of the devil in it, and that final part of the story is a representation of the Passion of Christ. Again, numerical clues that Beowulf chooses 12 apostles. One's a traitor.
Right, I thought that was interesting. Right.
Yeah, so these are numerical clues that allow us to see the parallels between Beowulf's passion and death, and the passion, death, and resurrection of Christ.
Now, another one that was very popular and probably more has been talked about is the Divine Comedy. You make the point that Dante was an avid disciple of the angelic doctor, St. Thomas Aquinas. Why is that important to understand in understanding Dante?
Yeah, well, basically, first of course, St. Thomas Aquinas is called the angelic doctor because he's probably the most important Catholic theologian and philosopher. And Dante's a disciple of him. So we need to read the Divine Comedy Thomistically, in the light of Thomistic theology and philosophy. In other words, in the light of the teachings of the Church. Mm-hmm. So the Divine Comedy is a profoundly orthodox work because it's written by a profoundly orthodox poet.
Mm-hmm. Who had some political axes to grind at the same time, I believe, during some of this, didn't he?
He did, which is why you've got to have the footnotes, because he's dealing with a lot of topical stuff, about the 13th century.
Italian politics. Right, and also who shows up in hell and who you might. But I thought the greatest image he had was the idea of at the heart of hell is frozen.
Yes.
And the wings of the devil effectively keep the devil trapped.
Yes.
As he flaps his wings, he just keeps it cold so he can't escape.
Yeah, this idea that ultimately evil is futile and impotent,
Right.
And I think the other thing about it, of course, the whole story, the Divine Comedy, reflects the Triduum. So it begins on Maundy Thursday, begins on the Holy Thursday. Dante descends into hell on Good Friday. He emerges from hell into the foot of Mount Purgatory into the light of the sun on Easter Sunday morning, and ascends Mount Purgatory and ascends into heaven during the Easter Octave. So it's very liturgical work as well.
Right, and Beatrice is the one who takes him there because Virgil, in theory, can't go, right?
Right, exactly. Which grace? Basically, Beatrice, the Blessed Virgin Mary sends St. Lucy, the patron saint of the blind, who asked Beatrice, who asked Virgil. So this is like a communion of saints, mm-hmm. That we can't do anything without the help of grace, and that grace comes through the communion of saints and the help of the saints in heaven.
It's interesting, too, because you also earlier talked in the book about the connection between Penelope, obviously, from the Odyssey, and then Portia, from the Merchant of Venice, and then a connection also with the women are an important part of the salvation story.
Exactly. The idea of the perfect feminine, so again, it prefigures the Blessed Virgin Mary in the case of Penelope and reflects back on the Blessed Virgin as regards Shakespeare's Portia and Dante's Beatrice.
Now, this one would people would see as being a little more overtly, which is the Canterbury Tales by Chaucer. Now, I didn't realize he hadn't actually finished the work. Is that true?
No, it was a very ambitious work, and when he died, he hadn't finished. So he said they're fragments. But I would say one thing, that the story is made up of stories. Mm-hmm. So the point is that the individual tales, such as the Nun's Priest tale, are completed stories. Mm. But the whole overall, all of the pilgrims were supposed to tell two stories each. And he died long before he managed to achieve that.
Yeah, I was trying to remember. I don't remember if you commented on here, but I remember hearing that at times that the religious didn't always come out so well in the Canterbury Tales, but like the local parish priest or the parson came out much better.
Exactly. In the depiction of the parson in the general prologue, we have one of the beautiful ideal portraits of a saint, of a saintly priest, mm-hmm. and his brother, the ploughman, is a saintly layman. But yeah, against that, we've got corrupt friars and corrupt monks and corrupt prioresses. Mm-hmm. I mean, corruption in the church, like the poor, is always with us, right?
So, did our Lord say that they would always be with us, or are they just followed along? What about Sir Gawain and the Green Knight? This is one you hear the name, nobody knows what it is, but there was a movie that was done not too long ago about
I think
this.
It was a recent film which I have not seen, but the J.R.R. Tolkien is obviously a favorite of mine. He translated Sir Gawain the Green Knight from the Middle English, from the English of the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. But again, Sir Gawain the Green Knight, the story begins during the Christmas season, ends during the Christmas season. The pilgrimage begins on All Souls Day. He's in the desert during the penitential season of Advent. Mm-hmm. So again, as with Dante, it follows liturgical imagery and symbolism.
Mm-hmm. Now, all of these particular stories, you've got Caesar, Julius Caesar, and Hamlet, and I'll skip Twelfth Night, but Othello, obviously, and as well as King Lear. And you're a strong proponent of the idea that Shakespeare came at things from a Catholic perspective, right?
Absolutely. So I've actually done two series for
right,
EWTN,
right.
And the first was based upon my book, The Quest for Shakespeare, which shows the biographical evidence for Shakespeare's Catholicism. And the second series I did for EWTN was based upon my second book, Through mm-hmm. Shakespeare's Eyes, which shows the textual evidence from the plays. So that's what I'm doing there as well.
Right.
I'm covering more plays in this book than I managed to cover in the series.
Right, and also Macbeth and even Antony and Cleopatra. And you talk about at the end is The Tempest, one of the many mysteries surrounding the life of William Shakespeare. You say is the reason for his early retirement when he was still in his 40s, at the height of his power, still apparently in good health. So was there a certain amount of religious politics involved with that, you're thinking?
Oh, yes. At this point, basically, there was a Puritan historian who was connecting Shakespeare with the Jesuits. The Puritans were on the rise. About 30 years later, they would close the theaters down. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think things were getting very, very dangerous, and Shakespeare got to the stage where I've had enough of this. I'm going to retire to Stratford-upon-Avon and spend the last few years of my life in peace, which is basically what he did.
What he did. And because of the Catholic aspects were
yeah,
in the storylines.
Exactly.
Lines, and
he was not prepared to write anodyne stories devoid of the deepest meanings, which, of course, religious meanings.
Right.
So therefore, when they tried to silence him, he retired rather than be censored,
right.
Basically.
Right. There was a very popular musical in the 60s, Man of La Mancha, with a Possible Dream. And Don Quixote, you talk about Cervantes. I didn't realize he fought at the Battle of Lepanto.
He did. He was wounded at the Battle of Lepanto, actually. Mm-hmm. So he's actually a hero for Christendom as a warrior, as well as being... Because Don Quixote is often called the first ever novel.
Why is it? You mentioned that, too. Why is that the case?
Yeah, well, prior to that, basically, the narratives were either in verse form, they were in poetry form, such as Sir Gawain the Green Knight, Dante's Divine Comedy. Mm. So to have a prose narrative was novel. Novel.
There you go. Very
so
good.
There you go.
You said it. How did Gulliver's Travels get in here? you know, one thing that's great is for people to understand where the word Yahoo came from, but besides a search engine that nobody uses anymore. But you talk about Jonathan Swift in Dublin. Now, he wasn't Catholic, but he was a High Church Anglican.
High Church
Ireland,
Anglican.
Church of Ireland?
Yeah, he said Church of Ireland, High Church Anglican. So an enemy of Puritanism, an enemy of the new Enlightenment humanism, which basically becomes secularism. Mm. So Gulliver's Travels, I mean, Gulliver is a sort of gullible traveler, his name, Gullible Traveler. So the story is about this person who's basically hoodwinked by all the fads and fashions of the age and is made to look foolish thereby. So it's a warning against following fashions instead of following truth, basically.
I just wish he came up with names that weren't so hard to pronounce. And the people he'd visit, he'd also have these interesting, outside of Lilliput, everybody else was somewhat tough to understand, the name of that giant girl, etc. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, one of the influential novels of the 19th century, one of the most confused and confusing. Well, isn't it just about somebody who thinks they can be God? No?
Well, that's the large part of it. So the subtitle of it is the modern Prometheus. Mm. Prometheus, is, of course, is a rebel against God and God's power.
So because of fire, right?
He steals the gift of fire. Right. So he's the Satan figure. So it's absolutely, that's a large part of it. But it's a bit confusing because the author was sort of confused by various philosophies. It's a bit of a mixed up novel.
Right.
But the mythological aspect of it about trying to play God is absolutely true.
Right. Yeah. I mean, her husband there was an interesting thought process going on at the time. You actually have a book called The Path to Rome, and that's the finest work of literature that Hilaire Belloc ever wrote. Why do you think it's his best?
Well, first of all, I'm agreeing with him, which is good.
Okay, right, okay.
he thought it was his best work. Okay. It's certainly his most literary.
Because the other one, The Four Men, I thought you thought maybe that was even better.
I love it as much. I mean, there's a bit of a difference between an objective judgment, what's the best, and what's your favorite.
Okay.
So, it's subjective. But you know, it's basically the Path to Rome is a real pilgrimage that Belloc took to Rome at the turn of the 20th century, mm-hmm. but there's all sorts of metaphorical stuff going on. So the pilgrimage is also, it's us, as in a Divine mm-hmm. Comedy, that the pilgrim is an everyman figure, so we are also on the pilgrimage, and the pilgrimage to Rome is the pilgrimage of life, Rome is heaven. So there's all sorts of metaphorical, parabolic, it's a parable of every man's journey to heaven, basically.
Right. The Lord of the World. Now, this is one that has come up, and our recent Holy Father, who passed on, had even talked about the Lord of the World. And this is Robert U. Benson. It seemed to have been a work that most people don't know about, but is pretty important in the sense of where we are today.
Yeah. So you and I were chatting before the show about the two great dystopian novels of the 20th century, 1984. And Brave New World, but I think Lord of the World should be seen with those two as a triumvirate. Robert Hugh Benson was a Catholic priest, so it's looking at this dystopian future from a profoundly Catholic perspective and the dangers of the rise of secular humanism and tyranny, and how should Catholics respond to that. And it's very timely and timeless.
And also the book By What Authority?
Yes, yeah, so Robert Hugh Benson, again, was many people haven't heard of him. He was a convert to the faith, son of the Archbishop of Canterbury, became a priest. But
that's why it was such a big deal that he converted.
Exactly. It was probably the most, other than Newman's conversion, the most controversial conversion of the whole period. But, you know, he wrote a number of best-selling novels prior to World War I. He died tragically young. But many of them were historical novels about the persecution of the church during the reigns of Henry VIII and Elizabeth I. So By What Authority is one of those historical novels.
And, of course, you have in here The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings. So other ones what about Vinland? That was an odd one, you think. I mean, what are the Vikings doing?
George Mackay Brown, the author of that, was from the Orkney Islands, the north of Scotland. Mm. He won all sorts of literary prizes, a major writer and poet. But that's, again, a profoundly Catholic work based upon a true story, the history of the time of the conversion of the Orkney Islands to Catholic Christianity. And there's a really profound ending where basically his death is mystically like sailing into the mystic west at the end of Lord of the Rings. to heaven. I mean, it's a work that people don't know they should know, which is why it's in the book.
So let me ask you a question. If somebody was thinking here, gee, there's like 50 different works here, does it matter which one I start on?
No, it doesn't. And I think the good thing about the book, you don't have to start from page one of the book either. You just dip in. But no, those 50 great books are books that we all should try to find time to read. We can read them in any order we like, and as many as we like. And my main hope is it will serve as an appetizer, that basically people read that and say, well, that particular book, that sounds interesting. I'm going to go and read it. So I'm hoping this will be something that takes people further up and further in to reading the books in full, rather than just the summaries offer there.
Right. Well, should somebody start with one of the smaller books? Like, well, everybody in high school read Lilies of the Field because it was 100 pages. you end up with a tome, and it's like, how am I going to get through this?
Well, it's a bit like if you go to the gym, you don't start lifting weights. You're too heavy for you.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah, you know yourself, and start small. And then when you can take when you take whole foods,
right.
When you're heavier food, then read some of the others.
Speaking of that, what are you working on? You're always working on something.
Well, the book I'm working on, I'm currently writing a series for Crisis Magazine called Unsung Heroes of Christendom.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about heroes of the church that are not as well known as they should be for whatever reason.
Who would be an example of one?
Where should I begin? So some of the English martyrs that no one's heard of. So St. Henry Walpole, for instance.
Okay.
Very, very fascinating stories. Or people like Marshall McLuhan, who used to be very well known,
sure,
but it's now largely forgotten. And
that's
so
right.
Trying to resurrect people that were very important in the past.
We have a very cool medium, that's
exactly.
That's right. Marshall McLuhan, very good. Thank you so much, Joe.
My pleasure.
Always
Thank
a pleasure
you.
Being with you. The one and only Joe Pierce, of course, classic literature made simple as only he could do it. 50 great books in a nutshell, published by our friends at Ignatius Press, naturally available through our EWTN religious catalog. Member EWTNRC.com for all things Catholic, including good books. Check us out next time right here on Bookmark. See you then.